I say unto you, lecture number 6, 28th of October, 1977, at the Bhagwanji Rajneesh Ashram. The first question. I could not follow the relationship between the five minds you talked about and the sayings of Jesus. Will you please enlighten? My God, so I have to go into it again? I was thinking I'm finished with those five minds. But it is not a surprise. I was expecting something like that, because I had not made it clear. I had only given you a few hints, and that too very indirect. If you had meditated over it, you would have found the relationship. But you don't want to work at all. You don't want to do any homework. Let us try to go into it again. The five minds were, first, the pre-mind. Let us call it the primal. Second, the collective mind. Let us call it the social. Third, the individual mind, the ego mind. Fourth, the cosmic mind, the universal mind. And the fifth, the no mind, Christ mind, Buddha mind. Let us call it the transcendental. The first thing to be understood is that Jesus sayings are addressed to the third mind, the individual, because they can be addressed only to the third mind. All the scriptures are addressed to the third mind, because only at the point of the third understanding is possible. Difficult, but possible. Up to the second mind, the social, you don't have any understanding. You are imitative. You are just a member of a great mechanism called society. You don't have any identity. You cannot be aggressed. You cannot be provoked. Nobody exists in you. You are just an echo. Echo of the society, the church, the state, the country. Echo of many things. But just the echo. You are not yet real. How can you understand before that? That's why a Jesus or a Buddha is born in a highly evolved society. They are not born in primitive societies. Buddha was born in Bihar, not in Bastar. Bihar was the highest peak of Indian mind in those days. Never again Indian consciousness touched that climate. Jesus was born at the pinnacle of Jiva's consciousness. He is the fruit and the flower of the whole Jiva's history. he could not have been born anywhere else. For Jesus to exist, a certain milieu is needed. Certain people are needed who can understand him. Certain people are needed who can not only understand him but can be transformed by him. So the first thing, the sutras of Jesus are addressed to the third mind, the individual mind, the ego mind. The ego has a certain function to fulfill. It is not just useless. It becomes a hindrance if you go higher than the third. But you cannot go higher than it if it is not there. It is a must. It is a necessary step. Only the ego can understand the misery of being in the ego. The social mind cannot understand it. The problem has not yet arisen. So the solution is meaningless. If you are suffering from a disease, then the medicine, the remedy becomes significant. If you are not suffering from the disease, the remedy is not a remedy for you. The social mind has not suffered yet from the ego. Hence, anything that helps to go beyond ego is utterly meaningless. It has no point of reference. It has no context. Jesus talks to the third mind. Remember it. If you are still in the second mind, Jesus will remain an enigma to you. If you are just a Christian or a Jew or a Hindu, then you will not be able to understand Jesus. Just think, in those days, the people who have gathered around Jesus must have been very, very individualistic people. Otherwise, how it was possible for them to listen to somebody who was so rebellious, who was so radical, who was turning the whole society upside down, who was saying continuously, "It has been told to you in the old days, but I say unto you," and was denying all that has been said, was continuously dismantling, destroying, of course to create something new, but an ordinary Jew will not be able to come close quarters to Jesus. It would have been too much. Only few individuals, rebellious people, must have gathered around him. The social mind gave him crucifixion. The society, the formal, the Pharisee, the rabbi, the moralist, the Puritan, they all gathered together to kill him. Because he was bringing something of the individual consciousness. He was creating individuality in people. This is the first thing to understand, how the sutras relate to the five minds. First, they are addressed to the third, and they can only be addressed to the third. The first, the primal, will not be able even to listen. The second, the social can listen but will not be able to understand. The third, the individual can understand but will not be able to follow. But once understanding, intellectual understanding at least, has arisen, then the door opens. Only the fourth mind can follow, the universal. When ego has been dropped, when ego has been used and dropped, when the ego's function is fulfilled, it is no more necessary. One has gone beyond it, the boat can be left behind. So remember, the first cannot even listen, the second can listen but cannot understand, the third can understand but cannot follow, the fourth can follow, but only follow, the fifth can become. The transcendental mind. This is how they are related. The second thing to remember, Jesus says, enter ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction. And many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. Visualize the third mind. It is just in the middle, halfway. Two minds are below it, two minds are above it. The social mind is below it, and the universal mind is above it. Both look alike. And these are the only two ways open for the individual mind to go. Otherwise you will feel stuck. In life, one has to continuously move. It is movement. It is process. If you feel stuck, you will become miserable. One has to go on and on, till the goal is reached. Standing in the third mind, the individual ego faces two possibilities. Either it can go up and become universal mind, or it can fall back and can become the social mind. Both look alike. That's why Jesus says, Enter ye in at the straight gate. Both gates are straight. And both look very alike. What is their similarity? The universal mind has dropped the ego. It is in tune with the whole. The social mind has not created the ego yet. It is in tune with the social. But both have a kind of attunement. The social mind is at ease with the society. It flows rhythmically. It's smoothly. It has no struggle, conflict. It fits altogether. It is adjusted. Adjusted with the society, but society is a big thing. It almost looks as if you are adjusted with God. The social mind is very normal. That's what psychoanalysts go on doing. Whenever somebody becomes too much of an individual, they say he is maladjusted. Then what they do? They bring you to the straight gate, the social. They help you to adjust with the society. that they call normal health, that they call psychological health. It reduces tension, it reduces inconveniences, it makes you more comfortable and secure, but at a great cost. Religion also helps you to go beyond tensions, but not to the second door. Religion helps you to go to the third door. That is the difference between psychoanalysis and religion. Religion also makes you adjusted, but not with the society. It makes you adjusted with the whole, with the universe, with God. That is the real adjustment. And great joy arises out of it. To be adjusted with the society is a very, very tiny arrangement. You will be less tense, but not more joyous. Remember it. The fourth mind will give you joy, celebration. The second mind will simply help you to remain more calm and quiet and collected. But there will be no ecstasy. Let ecstasy be always the criterion. Whenever you go high, your ecstasy grows. If you go low, your ecstasy is diminished. But both look alike because both are adjustments. In one, you drop being the individual. You become a sheep. You start imitating people. You become part of the mob. The mob may be wrong itself. That is not the question, but you adjust with it. The mob may be neurotic. And in fact, it is so. Mobs are more neurotic than individuals. Friedrich Nietzsche has said, and rightly, that as far as individuals are concerned, neurosis is a rare accident. But as far as mobs are concerned, that is the rule, not the exception. Mobs have always been neurotic. Adjust with the mob. You will feel good. Because now you are part of the social neurosis. You don't have a private neurosis. You will never feel it. Everybody is just like you. Things feel perfectly good. That's why Jesus says both the gates are alike. Both are straight. But there is a great difference. And the difference is, enter ye in at the straight gate. For wide is the gate. If you go backwards, the gate is wide. And broad is the way. But if you go upwards, narrow is the way. Very narrow. In fact, you have to go alone. You cannot take anybody with you. If you go to the fourth, you will have to go alone. You will have to go in absolute aloneness. That's why solitude, meditation, prayer have to be done all in aloneness. You cannot get into the fourth with all your friends, family, acquaintances, etc. You will have to leave everybody behind. You will have to move on a very, very narrow path. It is so narrow that even it cannot contain two together. You cannot take even your wife, your husband, your son, your mother. There is no way. You have to go alone. It is solitary. You can help others also to go to it, but they will go in their own solitariness. Remember, the higher you go, the more alone you are. The lower you go, the more you are with people. It is like a pyramid. The lowest of the pyramid has the biggest base. The base is the biggest. Then as you go higher, the pyramid becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And at the apex, it is just a point. You can visualize these minds in this way. The primal is the base of the pyramid. The social is very close to the base, a little smaller than the base. The individual is very close to the apex, to the peak, far away from the base. And the universal is just a point, the apex. And when you have jumped even beyond that, the pyramid disappears. And the fifth, the transcendent, it is not part of the pyramid at all. The third mind is addressed by Jesus, and is told that these are the two possibilities. If you enter with the collectivity, you will be destructing yourself. It will be destructive. It will not be creative. You will not be born out of it. It will be simple suicide. There will be no resurrection in it. Enter ye in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction. And many there be which go in thereat. The majority follows that. That's why you don't see flowering. You don't see eyes full of its splendor. You don't see people in a dance. You don't see hearts singing. You don't see pulsating life energy. You don't see streaming vitalities. You simply see dull, stale, stagnant, dirty pools, no more flow. And when the flow disappears, glow also disappears. Then you are slowly, slowly dying and doing nothing. This is destruction. If you follow the higher, the universal mind, because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way. That narrow has to be remembered always. With the social, you can be with the mob. With the individual, you cannot be with the mob. You can be only with a small group of people. You will always find, whenever there are egoist people, they will create small groups, their own societies, clubs, lodges. They will not move with the mass. They will have their own chosen few, select few. They will move in them. Authors will move with authors. Poets will move with poets. Painters will have their own clubs, their own restaurants, where they will meet. They will have their own superiors. Small groups, and they will be very choosy who is to be allowed. With the fourth, you are alone, not even a club of the chosen people. You are alone. With the fifth, you are not even alone. Even you have disappeared. This is how it goes. Slowly, slowly, things go on disappearing. First the mass, then the small societies, groups, clubs, then you and one day there is only emptiness in your hands. That emptiness is what Jesus calls kingdom of God. Buddha calls nirvana. Third, Jesus talks about prayer. Prayer is the way, Jesus' way to be alone. Buddha's way is meditation. Jesus' way is prayer. But the intrinsic quality has to be the same. Jesus says, be silent. Language is not needed. Language is helpful in the social. In the universal, language is not needed. Language is a social phenomenon. Animals don't have language because they don't have societies. Man has language because man has society. Man is a social animal. When you start moving beyond society, language becomes irrelevant. Language is to relate with the other. And God is not the other. God is your innermost core. There is no need for any language. So Jesus says, and when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are. For they love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets, that they may be seen of men. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. Don't pray for people to see that you are praying, that you are religious. Don't pray as is so. Don't make it a performance. It is sacrilegious. Prayers should be in solitude. Nobody should know about it. There is no need. It is nobody else's concern. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet. What he means by closet? He means drop all language from your mind, all verbalization from your mind. The moment you drop verbalization from your mind, you have moved in such a private world, nobody else can go there. Language dropped, you have dropped the whole world. Just think of it. If for a moment there is no language inside you, then where you are no more here, no more in this world. You are in a world totally different from this. When there is no language in you, you are utterly private. Language makes you public. No language makes you private. This is what Jesus means when he says, but thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet. Drop all language and verbalization. All communication has to be dropped. You have to be just there, silent, present, but utterly non-verbal, not saying a single thing. And when thou hast shut thy doors, when the door on the language, on the verbal, on the linguistic mind has been closed, pray to the Father in secret. Then just be a deep gratefulness, a gratitude. Then bow down to the unknown. Then surrender before the mysterious. Then just be in awe, in wonder. This is what prayer is. This is the entry from the ego to the universal, from the third to the fourth. language is the medium to relate with others, and silence is the medium to relate with God, because God is not the other. Only in silence you commune with your own inner being. Logic is the way in the world. Love is the way in God. Prayer is a loving silence, nothing else. If you ask me what is prayer, I will say a loving silence. Silence. Silence, but utterly full of love, overflowing with love. If silence is there and love is not there, then it is meditation. If silence is there and suffused with love, fragrant with love, then it is prayer. That is the only difference. If you can savor your silence with love, it becomes prayer. If you cannot, then it remains meditation. Both lead. So there is no problem of higher and lower. Neither meditation is higher, nor prayer is higher. There are two types of people in the world. The man and the woman. The people of intelligence and the people of love. Jesus belongs to the second type. His path is the path of love. Buddha's path is the path of intelligence. Buddha says, just be silent, and you will jump from the third to the fourth. Jesus says, be silent and full of love, and you will jump from the third to the fourth. Both are bridges. If it appeals to you, if it feels that it strikes in your heart, that the idea simply clicks in your being, then prayer is your way. But try both. If you are confused, try both. Whichever feels good is good, because both are as potent as the others. All words belong to the social, silence belongs to the universal. And in the transcendental, even silence disappears. First language disappears, then silence too. Then there is absolute silence, when silence has also disappeared. This is the meaning when Jesus says, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. He surrenders in deep love, in silence. And remember, these are not the words to be repeated. Christians have misunderstood Jesus. These are not the words to be repeated. These are the emotions to be lived, not words to be repeated, but emotions to be lived. Thy kingdom come. Now this can be just a word in you. You can repeat it. Or this can be a feel in you. Thy kingdom come. Not a single word is uttered inside, but this is your feeling. Your hands are raised to receive the kingdom. You are surrendered. Your heart is open. You are ready for God to descend in you. Do you see the difference? Don't repeat the words. Let it be a feeling, and then it will go deeper. And then it will really become a prayer. And the fourth thing about the transcendentals, ask and it shall be given you, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. What Jesus means by saying it, ask and it shall be given you. He means that really it is already given to you. You have not been able to see it because you have not asked for it. The door is already open. But because you have not knocked at it, it has remained open and yet closed for you. It is just for asking's sake that you will get it. It is possible only if you have already got it. Otherwise, how you can get anything just by asking? You try. You want to have a big palace. Just for the asking, you are going to get it. You are not going to get it just for asking. Otherwise, all beggars will be emperors. You don't have it, and you will have to work hard, and then too there is no necessity that you will have it. You may succeed, you may not succeed, there are 1,001 competitors too. You will have to go through being very aggressive, and you will have to put all that you have at the stake, and then too, more possibilities are that you will be a loser. You want money, you cannot get just for the asking. You want prestige, power, respectability, fame, you will not get just for the asking. But Jesus says, God you can have just for the asking. What does he mean? It is incredibly significant statement. He simply means what Buddha means when he says, that you have it already there. You are not to achieve it. It is your intrinsic nature. This is Jesus' way of saying the same thing. You can get only by asking because you are already there. The asking will make you alert, that's all. If you ask consciously, if you knock consciously, if you start groping consciously, you will become alert of that which has already been there, which has always been there, which has been the case from the very beginning. God is given to you. You are carrying God within you. But you have not asked. Your desire has not become conscious. So God is there, you are there, but there is no bridge. By asking, you will create the bridge. If the asking is immense, tremendous, total, then in a single instant, the bridge will be projected. The kingdom of God is within you. That's why ask and it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. This is how these sutras are related with the five minds. But they are basically addressed to the third mind. To those who seek identity, Norman Brown advocates get lost. And Timothy Leary says drop out. But I say to you that to get lost, one must have found oneself first. And to drop out, one must have been in first. You can drop out if you ask. You can get lost if the ego is ready and ripe. That is the difference between a sannyasin and a hippie. A hippie is one who has been trying to drop something which he has not got yet. who is trying to drop something which he has not earned yet. Who is trying to renounce something which is not theirs. A sannyasin is one who has come to feel the ripe ego, and feeling the misery and anguish of it, drops it. Both look alike. Both look alike, but the hippie is not going from the third to the fourth. The hippie has not been in the third yet. He will fall in the second. That's why hippies start creating their own clan, their own tribe, their own society. It has almost the same structure as the old society that they have left. If in the old society you cannot have long hair, in a hippie society you cannot have short hair. The structure is the same. If in the old society you cannot go on without taking a bath for months, in the hippie society you are not allowed to take the bath every day. That is too conventional. You will look a little antisocial if you take the bath every day. But it is the same society, repeated, the same structure. Even though it is against, but it is the same structure. The hippie is not getting beyond society. He is getting against one society and creating another. The sannyasin is going beyond society. He is moving away from the very need of being part of a society. These sutras are addressed to the egoist. But remember, the egoist can understand them but cannot follow. To follow it, you will have to start dropping your ego. Then you can follow. Then the universal mind will arise in you. The prayer is the way, or meditation. And when the universal has arrived, don't stop there. One step more. This very consciousness that you have arrived, this very consciousness that I have realized God, this very consciousness that I have become one with God, has to be drawn to. This is the last barrier to be dropped. Once it has gone, you and the whole are one. So one that there is nobody even to say that I am one with the whole. That is the transcendental. That's what Jesus calls the kingdom of God. The second question, where is the meeting between Christ's love and Buddha's intelligence? In me. The third question, do you teach? Then one should not plan for the future at all. Psychologically, one should not plan for the future at all. But that does not mean that practically you should not plan. The difference is great and has to be understood. If you are going to travel, if you are going to the Himalayas, you will have to go to the railway station and book your tickets few days ahead. That's simply practical. You cannot say that when the idea arises to go to the Himalayas, I will simply go. It will be difficult. You may not get a ticket on the train or on the plane. don't be foolish. But psychologically, yes, don't plan for the future. What is the meaning of psychological? You are here, and in your mind's eye, you start trekking in the Himalayas. And you start enjoying. Just in fantasy. You are already there where you are not. This is psychological. This has to be dropped. But practical things are perfectly okay. Don't live psychologically in the past or in the future. But practically, sometimes you will have to remember past things. You will have to remember your name. And you will have to remember your wife. You cannot come home every day and ask, who are you? Let us introduce ourselves. You will have to remember the past for practical purposes. But don't live there. The past is gone. The memory is there. Use it whenever is needed. But don't start living in those memories. Don't waste time. Because if you live in your memories, who is going to live in the present? Then the present is wasted. And living in the memory is just a dream. It is not real life. It is pseudo. It is false. And don't live in the future. People live in the future. They are always planning to go to the Kashmir or to the Switzerland. And they are living there already. They dream. They think. They fantasize. What they are going to do there. How they will enjoy the life there. And remember, when they will reach to Switzerland, they will not be there. Because by that time, they will start planning how to come back home. And the business. And the family. And everything. They are never at the place they are. They go on missing. They are always rushing and never arriving. Don't live in the future, don't live in the past. But that doesn't mean that don't think of practical things. A man was on holiday in Ireland. One day he was driving along a little used road, when he came across a pretty young girl trying to hitch a lift. So he offered her a lift. After a few minutes, he asked if he could hold her hand. To be sure, came the reply. A little further on, he asked if he could kiss her. To be sure, she replied. A few miles later, they passed through a village. The girl asked him to stop at the chemist's shop. Why? Asked the man. To be sure, replied the girl. This much practicalness is allowed. More than that is not needed. The fourth question, you said that sometimes it is dangerous to push, and you are pushing me very hard. Well, I guess you know what you are doing, but what are you doing? Tushita, that is none of your business. The fifth question, why do I cry whenever something real happens in meditation? Sometimes even during lectures, when you say something that it strikes me as my own truth, tears come to my eyes and I tremble with silent sobs. What is the connection between truth and tears? The question is from Michael got leave. First, it may be got leave that only tears are true in you. Everything else has become false. Your smile, your face, your gestures, your words, all may have become false. It may be that only tears are still true. That's why whenever you hear something of truth, they start surfacing. They are in tune with truth. And this is not only so with you, this is so with many people. Tears have not been corrupted too much. Particularly in men. About women, it is not so true. Their tears may be just facades. Their tears may be their diplomacies. Their tears may be their tricks, strategies. But about men, because tears have not been allowed to men at all. People have been told from their very childhood that if you are a man, then tears are not available for you. You should never cry. So tears have remained there, uncorrupted by the society, unpolluted by the society. At least it is so with men. So whenever you hear something of truth, something that simply goes and becomes a song in your heart, something that simply penetrates like a ray of light into your darkness, tears come, because the true calls forth the true in you. Michael Gottlieb's name is beautiful. Gottlieb means God love. Maybe there is a great desire for God, a great love for God. Which is getting ready every day. Which is going to purchase you. Allow those tears. Because the danger is that you may be repressing them. Gottlieb is a psychologist. That is the danger. You may start rationalizing. You may start finding explanations. You may start stopping those tears, which are innocent as dewdrops, which are uncorrupted by your mind, come from the beyond. Those tears are coming from your heart. Don't start explaining them. Psychologists have become very clever in explaining away everything. Live with the mystery of the tears. When they come, allow them. Go into those sobs. Those sobs are the beginning of prayer in you. Flow in those tears totally, unashamed. Don't feel embarrassed. Go wholeheartedly into them. And through them, you will be cleansed and purified. Those tears will become your very alchemy. Their very touch will turn you into gold. I have been watching Gottlieb. He has been here only for a few days. And deep down he is afraid of sannyas. First he was going to stay only for 10 days, then he extended few days, now he has extended little more. And by he is getting trapped. Now the tears have started to come. Now it is dangerous but leave. But still you are not allowing them a total flow. Be swayed by them. Let that thought go to your very cells and the fibers of your being. Let those tears dance in and around you. And through those tears, you will be initiated. Through those tears, you are coming close to me and I am coming close to you. If you allow, something is going to happen, something immensely valuable. But it depends on you, whether you will allow it or you will escape before it becomes too much. To be here needs courage. To be with me means risk. If you decide to be with me, you are risking finding yourself. The risk is there. And to find oneself, one has to die to one's whole past. Because the new can come only when the old has disappeared. Let those tears take your past. Let them wash you. They are preparing you for me. And you have a heart which can grow in prayers. But if you allow, only then. Nothing can be done against you. And up to now you have been fighting. You have been protecting, safeguarding yourself. You are keeping a little bit aloof, distant, then you are doing at your own risk. You may miss the opportunity. The fifth question. Bhagwan, in today's lecture, you said there are 3 stages, sex, love and prayer. But if one keeps on changing the partner, how can one go into depth? How can one reach the highest stage at all? The question is Samma Yoga Mukta. This question arises to many people. And because she is the Indian, it has more relevance to her conditionings. People think that if you are in love with one person, only then love can go deep. That is utter nonsense. The depth of love has nothing to do with one person or 2 persons. The depth of love has something to do, certainly, that you should remain in love always. That brings depth. Now, for example, you love a man or a woman. For a few days, things are really fantastic. Things are going beautiful. And then, things start becoming dull. Naturally. Nothing wrong in it. It is just the very course of nature. You become acquainted with the woman, her ways. She becomes acquainted with you, your ways, your lifestyle. And when everything is known, interest starts dimming. When everything is known and there is nothing surprising anymore, how can the relationship remain fantastic? The wonder starts disappearing. Things settle, become mundane, day to day, ordinary. This is what ordinarily happens. Now, you can go on living with the man or the woman with the idea that if you change the man or the woman, love will never go deep, but love is not going deep at all. Love is becoming shallower every day. Sooner or later, you will start taking the other for granted. There will be no joy in the other's presence. You will not be thrilled by the other's presence. You can go on clinging. And Mukta has asked this question because she was trying to cling to a certain sannyasi. Trying hard to cling. And because she tried hard, the sannyasi escaped. My people are very, very intelligent. If you cling too hard, then nobody is going to be with you. Because nobody wants imprisonment. Nobody wants you to become a fetter. The more you cling, the more the relationship becomes ugly. First, it loses joy, loses all charm, loses all magnetism, and then it starts becoming ill, pathological. I call a relationship pathological when you are clinging only for clinging's sake. There is nothing else to cling. You are simply clinging because you are afraid to lose, afraid to change, afraid to move in a new relationship. Because the new, who knows how it is going to turn to, where it will lead. The new is dangerous, because the new is not yet familiar. The old is familiar, settled, there is a certain security, a comfort, a convenience. When you start clinging for clinging's sake, then it is pathological, it is ugly. It is not going to bring any depth in your relationship. All depth will disappear. You can go and see millions of husbands and wives. What depth, what intimacy is there? Now, I am not saying that if you are with a certain person, with a man or a woman, and things are still growing, change. I'm not saying that. Don't misunderstand me. There are few people who are so sensitive that they can go on finding something new in the other every day. There are people who are so aesthetic that they never feel that things are ever finished. Their sensitivity, their intensity, their passion goes on bringing new depths, then it is perfectly good. My criterion is, if a relationship is growing towards depth, it is perfectly good. Go on. Exhaust it if you can. But if it is not growing, if it is not deepening, if the intimacy is not flowering anymore, all has stopped,
and you are simply stuck because you don't know how to leave and how to say goodbye. Then you are destroying your capacity for love. It is better to move, change the partners, than to destroy love. Because love is the goal, not the partners. You love a person not for the person's sake. You love the person for love's sake. Love is the goal. So if it is not happening with this person, let it happen with somebody else, but let it happen. Allow it a continuity. That continuity, that flow of love constantly happening, will make you deeper into it, will bring depth, will bring new dimensions, will bring new realizations. So remember, if it is going on good with one person, and by good I don't mean what ordinarily is meant when somebody says they are a good couple, are very nice. I don't mean that. Those words just hide facts. A nice family means no conflict, no problem. Things are going smoothly. The wheels of the mechanism are moving smoothly. That's all. But a really beautiful relationship is not just nice. It is far out. Never settle for less. Only a far out relationship can bring death. If it is not happening, be courageous to say goodbye. With no complaint, with no grudge, with no anger. What can you do? If it is not happening, it is not happening. You cannot make the other feel guilty. What he can do, whatever he can do, he is doing. Whatever you can do, you are doing. But it is somehow not happening. You are not fitting with each other. You are not meant for each other. Then don't go on forcing. It is like putting a square plug in a round hole. Go on. It won't happen. And if you succeed, every possibility is you may have destroyed the plug completely. Then it will not be worth. But mind functions through conditionings. Now Mukta's mind is basically Indian. The Indian conditioning is very long. For thousands of years, in India it has been taught that you should be true to one person. I am teaching you a totally different thing. I am teaching you to be true to love, not to persons. Be true to love. Never betray love. That's all. If sometimes persons have to be changed, they have to be changed. But never betray love. The old Indian tradition is betray love, but never betray the persons. Go on clinging to one person. And when things have been there for thousands of years, they become part of your blood and bones, part of your marrow. And you start functioning unconsciously. Mukta, become a little more conscious. Meditate over this anecdote. The day for the execution arrived, and the three prisoners, a Frenchman,
an Englishman and a German, were led out of their cells to the guillotine. The Frenchman was the first to be led up to the steps and was asked if he preferred to face upwards or downwards on the guillotine block. He replied, "I have led a full and good life, enjoying all the delights of good wine from the finest French vineyards, excellent cheeses, the best cuisine, and the wonderful charms of the most lovely mademoiselles of France. I have nothing more to wish for and nothing to fear. Therefore, I will face upwards." He was then positioned on his back, looking up so he could watch the blade as it descended. The blade was released and it began falling with full speed until it was only 1/2 inch from his neck, at which point the blade suddenly stopped. Unable to explain this, the authorities who were standing by interpreted it as a sign from God and proceeded to release the prisoner to become a free man. The Englishman was next to be led to the guillotine and was asked the same question. He replied, "I have served my queen loyally throughout the empire. In the true tradition of the refined Englishman, I have helped to spread our great English civilization around the world, and I have never flinched at danger. Therefore, I am ready to face death and will face upwards." He was positioned on his back and the blade was released and began falling. Again, at the last instant, the blade came to an abrupt stop just 1/2 inches above his throat. This was again interpreted as a sign from God, so the man was freed. Next, the German was led to the guillotine, and as he was being asked the same question, he immediately interrupted and said, "Before I answer your question, I want you to know that I refuse to be under that machine until you get it fixed." A German is a German. His conditioning is there. The machine should be fixed first. And that's how the Indian mind also functions. Down the ages you have been taught to remain true to persons, which is not a very high value. The higher value is to remain true to love. If it is happening with one person, perfectly good. I'm not saying change. What is the point of changing? If it is not happening with this person, then let it happen somewhere else, but let it happen. Because if you miss love, you will miss all that is beautiful in life. If you miss love, you will miss the possibility of prayer too, because only love, when it becomes deep, brings you closer to prayer. The sixth question: I do not believe in anything, but I do believe in God. Why are you so much against beliefs? Because a belief is a belief and is not an experience. The belief is a barrier. If you believe in God, you will never know God. That's why I am against the belief, because I am for God. Your very belief will never allow you to know that which is. Because the belief means, before knowing it, you have decided already what it is. Your decisive mind will not relax. Your mind with a conclusion is a prejudiced mind. and to know God, an empty mind is needed, unprejudiced, pure, uncontaminated by any belief, by any ideology. Because I am for God, that's why I am against all beliefs. And you say, I do not believe in anything else. But if you believe in God, then what else more is needed? That is enough. You have made the greatest mistake. Now every other mistake is very small. And if the great mistake has been done, then other mistakes will follow in the wake. If you can believe in God without knowing God, without understanding what it means, without ever experiencing even a little bit of it, without ever seeing a single ray of light, if you can believe in God, if you can be so deceptive, if you can be so cunning, then you can believe in anything. Then what else is needed? You think this belief is not a big mistake. This is the biggest mistake. A husband walked into his house unexpectedly one evening and noticed some men's clothing at the foot of the bed. He asked his wife, who was in the bed at the time? Where the clothes come from? His wife told him that the clothes belonged to him and he was taking them and she was taking them to the cleaners. Going to the closet to hang up his coat, he eyed a man bare as the day he came into the world. The husband, what are you doing here? The man, did you believe what your wife told you? The husband, yes. The man, well, I am waiting for a bus. If you can believe that, then you can believe anything. The man naked is standing in the closet, waiting for the bus. If you can believe in God, then you can believe in Adolf Hitler, in Joseph Stalin, in Mao Zedong. Then you can believe in any nonsense, because you have accepted the basic nonsense. Never believe in God. God has to be known, not to be believed. God has to be lived, not to be believed. God has to be experienced, not to be believed. And why do you believe in God? If you have not known, then it must be out of fear. Then there can be no other reason. Remember, God can be known only out of love. And beliefs come out of fear. And love and fear never meet. They never cross each other's path. Love knows no fear. Fear knows no love. If you are afraid of somebody, you cannot love that person. That's why it is very difficult for children to love their parents, because parents make them afraid. It is very difficult for husbands to love their wives, because wives make them afraid. It is very difficult for wives to love their husbands, because the husbands make them afraid. Wherever fear comes, fear comes from this door and love escapes from the other. They never live together. They can't live together. Have you not observed when you love a person, all fear disappears? In that very love, there is no fear. God has to be known through love, and belief is based in fear. Belief stinks. A salesman could not make the lady understand power brakes on the car he was selling her. So he took her for a ride. When he was almost 500 feet from a brick building, he speeded up, and at the last minute he hit the brakes. "Lady, what is that smell?" "Salesman, rubber burning, madam." She brought the car home to show her husband and took him for a ride. Coming to the same brick bar, she slammed on the brakes, missing it about 3 inches. Looking at her husband, she said, "Do you smell that, honey?" "Husband, I should. I am sitting in it." All beliefs stink. Drop beliefs. Have courage to know. God is an invitation for the ultimate journey. Let God be a quest, not a belief. Let it be a question mark on your heart, at the deepest core of your being. Let the question trouble you. Let the question become a turmoil. Let the question create a chaos in you. Because only through chaos stars are born. And only when the quest has destroyed all your beliefs, all your belief systems, and you are freed of all conclusions given by others, you will be able to open your eyes to the naked truth. And it is facing you. It is always facing you. It is just in front of your nose. But there is a great China wall of beliefs, and you cannot see that which surrounds you from everywhere. The last question. I and my wife both love you, but we often quarrel about you and your thoughts because we cannot agree in our interpretations of your ideas. What should we do? There is no need to agree. And how can you agree? When you listen to me, you listen through your preoccupation. When your wife listens, she listens through her preoccupation. When you listen through your own beliefs, ideas, conditions. When she listens, she has her own mind. Interpretations are going to be different. Just because you are both listening to me does not mean you will agree. You will interpret. You will give colors. You will give turns to ideas according to your mind. See the facts that with the mind there can be no agreement. There is no need to argue. Rather, what I am saying, try to do it. Don't waste your time. I am not here to make you more argumentative. I am not here to make you more logical. I am not here to make you more capable of discussing, analyzing, in repeating things. I am here to help you to see. And seeing comes when you are without the mind. Now this simple fact that you go on quarreling with your wife and you both love me should become a great experience. You are here. 1,000 people. I am saying the same thing to you all. But there are going to be 1,000 interpretations. You can't agree with the other. The other has looked from a totally different angle. Because the other is hooked in a totally different angle. That way only he or she can see it. And this is so, if you are not related with the person. If you are related with the person, then there are more difficulties, particularly in the relationship of a wife and husband. Their quarrel is eternal. It does not matter about what. They quarrel. There seems to be only one agreement, to disagree. That is their only agreement. About that they have agreed. That is a tacit agreement in every marriage, that they will disagree. Mullah Nasruddin goes on fighting with his wife, and the wife goes on arguing. One day I told Mullah that for 30 years you have been arguing, and there seems to be no possible solution. Why don't you drop it? He said, how to drop it? I said, you simply agree with your wife. Next time it happens, you simply agree and see what happens. He said, okay. So next time it happens, first in the heat of it, he forgot. He argued for 30 minutes. And then he suddenly remembered. So he went out in the garden to cool down. Then he cooled himself, collected himself, decided that he will agree. He went in. And he said to the wife, okay, you are right, I agree with you. The wife looked at him with great surprise and said, what? But I have changed my mind. And the argument starts again. They have changed sides, but the argument is the same. When you are related with somebody. Relationship brings many complexities. There is a constant struggle to dominate. It is not really argument that you are interested in or your wife is interested in. It is really a question who dominates to whom. Each point becomes a power struggle. Who dominates whom? See to it. And don't waste your time. And you ask me, what should we do? Let her have her opinions, you have your opinions. Rather than wasting time in the opinions, you start doing something according to your mind and let her do something according to her mind. But do something. If I say meditate, whatsoever you understand by it, start doing something. In the beginning, it is always a groping in the dark. But by and by, the gropers reach. Jesus says, seek and you will find. Knock and it shall be opened unto you. Ask and it shall be given. Start groping. And don't be worried that you may commit some error or some mistake. Errors have to be committed. Mistakes are going to happen. Nobody can reach directly. Everybody has to stumble. Many times one goes astray. But if one goes on working sincerely, authentically, then sooner or later the door opens. You open your door, let her open her door. Don't make me an excuse for your power struggle. and remember always, and have compassion on other people. They have their minds. They are hooked there just like as you are hooked in your own mind. See, because you cannot see without your mind, how you expect the other to see it. Watch life, and sooner or later you will see an insight arising in you. In that very insight, you will become capable to understand the other's standpoint. I'm not saying that you have to agree with the other, but you can understand. There is no need to agree. But you can see why the other is looking at this point in this way. Why? And you can have compassion for the other. And if you have compassion, you will be surprised. The other has started feeling compassion for you. If you argue, the other argues. Argument creates arguments. It goes on becoming bitter and more bitter. It poisons the relationship. If you can understand the other's standpoint, you will find the other is also more compassionate towards your standpoint. And people have their own standpoints because people are not enlightened. Standpoints are bound to be there up to the third mind, the individual mind. With the fourth mind, there is no argument. Compassion arises. One can see the other, where the other is hooked, and feel sorry for the other, because it is the imprisonment. Only with the fourth understanding, compassion, and with the fifth, one forgets about others. Are about oneself, then there is no division. Listen to few anecdotes. First, a housewife complains to the psychologist, "Something is wrong with my husband. At night when he comes back from work, he always first kisses our dog and then me." The psychologist thinks about it for a while, then he suggests thoughtfully, "Would you mind bringing a photograph of your dog the next time you come?" You cannot expect this, but this is possible.